I thought a lot about the fragility of small children. A 3-year-old is easily damaged. Dogs can bite him. Cars can hit him. Mean kids can push him over. He can get sick, and sometimes did. Julian was prone to high fevers and the delirium they sometimes produce. Sometimes I had to take him into the shower with me and cool him off when he was hallucinating or even fighting with me in his feverish state. There are few things that make it harder to accept the fundamental limitations of human existence than a sick child. Michaela, a year and a few months older than Julian, also had her problems. When she was 2, I would lift her up on my shoulders and carry her around. Kids enjoy that. Afterwards, however, when I put her feet back on the ground, she would sit down and cry. So I stopped doing it. That seemed to be the end of the problem, with a seemingly minor exception. My wife, Tammy, told me that something was wrong with Michaela's gait. I couldn't see it. Tammy thought it might be related to her reaction to being carried on my shoulders. Michaela was a sunny child and very easy to get along with. One day, when she was about 14 months old, I took her, along with Tammy and her grandparents, to Cape Cod when we lived in Boston. When we got there, Tammy and her mom and dad walked ahead and left me with Michaela in the car. We were in the front seat. She was lying there in the sun, babbling away. I leaned over to hear what she was saying. Happy, 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 happy. That's what she was like. When she turned 6, however, she started to get mopey. It was hard to get her out of bed in the morning. She put on her clothes very slowly. When we walked somewhere, she lagged behind. She complained that her feet hurt and that her shoes didn't fit. We bought her 10 different pairs, but it didn't help. She went to school and held her head up and behaved properly. But when she came home and saw her mom, she would break into tears. We had recently moved from Boston to Toronto and attributed these changes to the stress of the move. But it didn't get better. Michaela began to walk up and down stairs one step at a time. She began to move like someone much older. She complained if you held her hand. One time, much later, she asked me, "Dad, when you played this little piggy with me when I was little, was it supposed to hurt?" Things you learn too late. A physician at our local medical clinic told us, "Sometimes children have growing pains. They're normal. But you could think about taking her to see a physiotherapist." So, we did. The physiotherapist tried to rotate Michaela's heel. It didn't move. That was not good. The physio told us, "Your daughter has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis." This was not what we wanted to hear. We did not like that physiotherapist. We went back to the medical clinic. Another physician there told us to take Michaela to the hospital for sick children. The doctor said, "Take her to the emergency room. That way you will be able to see a rheumatologist quickly." Michaela had arthritis all right. The physio, bearer of unwelcome news, was correct. 37 affected joints. Severe polyarticular juvenile idiopathic arthritis. JIA. Cause? Unknown. Prognosis? Multiple early joint replacements. What sort of God would make a world where such a thing could happen at all? Much less to an innocent and happy little girl. It's a question of absolutely fundamental import for believer and non-believer alike. It's an issue addressed, as are so many difficult matters, in The Brothers Karamazov, the great novel by Dostoevsky we began to discuss in Rule 7. Dostoevsky expresses his doubts about the propriety of being through the character of Ivan, who, if you remember, is the articulate, handsome, sophisticated brother and greatest adversary of the monastic novitiate, Alyosha. It's not God I don't accept. Understand this, says Ivan. I do not accept the world that he created, this world of gods, and cannot agree with it. Ivan tells Alyosha a story about a small girl whose parents punished her by locking her in a freezing outhouse overnight, a story Dostoevsky culled from a newspaper of the time. Can you just see those two snoozing away while their daughter was crying all night? Says Ivan. And imagine this little child, unable to understand what was happening to her, beating her frozen little chest and crying meek little tears, begging gentle Jesus to get her out of that horrible place. Alyosha, if you were somehow promised that the world could finally have complete and total peace, but only on the condition that you tortured one little child to death, say, that girl who was freezing in the outhouse, would you do it? Alyosha demurs. No, I would not, he says softly. He would not do what God seems to freely allow. I had realized something relevant to this years before about 3-year-old Julian. Remember him? I thought, I love my son. He's 3 and cute and little and comical. But I'm also afraid for him because he could be hurt. If I had the power to change that, what might I do? I thought, he could be 20 feet tall instead of 40 inches. Nobody could push him over then. He could be made of titanium instead of flesh and bone. Then if some brat bounced a toy truck off his noggin, he wouldn't care. He could have a computer-enhanced brain. And even if he was damaged somehow, his parts could be immediately replaced. Problem solved. But no, not problem solved. And not just because such things are currently impossible. Artificially fortifying Julian would have been the same as destroying him. Instead of his little 3-year-old self, he would be a cold, steel-hard robot. That wouldn't be Julian. It would be a monster. I came to realize through such thoughts that what can be truly loved about a person is inseparable from their limitations. Julian wouldn't have been little and cute and lovable if he wasn't also prone to illness and loss and pain and anxiety. Since I loved him a lot, I decided that he was all right the way he was, despite his fragility. It's been harder with my daughter. As her disease progressed, I began to piggyback her around, not on my shoulders, when we went for walks. She started taking oral naproxen and methotrexate, the latter a powerful chemotherapy agent. She had a number of cortisol injections, wrists, shoulders, ankles, elbows, knees, hips, fingers, toes, and tendons, all under general anesthetic. This helped, temporarily, but her decline continued. One day, Tammy took Michaela to the zoo. She pushed her around in a wheelchair. That was not a good day. Her rheumatologist suggested prednisone, a corticosteroid, long used to fight inflammation. But prednisone has many side effects, not the least of which is severe facial swelling. It wasn't clear that this was better than the arthritis, not for a little girl. Fortunately, if that is the right word, the rheumatologist told us of a new drug. It had been used previously, but only on adults. So Michaela became the first Canadian child to receive etanercept, a biological specifically designed for autoimmune diseases. Tammy accidentally administered 10 times the recommended dose the first few injections. Poof! Michaela was fixed. A few weeks after the trip to the zoo, she was zipping around, playing little league soccer. Tammy spent all summer just watching her run. We wanted Michaela to control as much of her life as she could. She'd always been strongly motivated by money. One day we found her outside, surrounded by the books of her early childhood, selling them to passers-by. I sat her down one evening and told her that I would give her $50 if she could do the injection herself. She was 8. She struggled for 35 minutes, holding the needle close to her thigh. Then she did it. Next time I paid her $20, but only gave her 10 minutes. Then it was $10 and 5 minutes. We stayed at 10 for quite a while. It was a bargain. After a few years, Michaela became completely symptom-free. The rheumatologist suggested that we start weaning her off her medications. Some children grow out of JIA when they hit puberty. No one knows why. She began to take methotrexate in pill form instead of injecting it. Things were good for 4 years. Then, one day, her elbow started to ache. We took her back to the hospital. "You only have one actively arthritic joint," said the rheumatologist's assistant. It wasn't only. Two isn't much more than one, but one is a lot more than zero. One meant she hadn't grown out of her arthritis, despite the hiatus. The news demolished her for a month, but she was still in dance class and playing ball games with her friends on the street in front of our house. The rheumatologist had some more unpleasant things to say the next September, when Michaela started grade 11. An MRI revealed joint deterioration at the hip. She told Michaela, "Your hip will have to be replaced before you turn 30. Perhaps the damage had been done before the etanercept worked its miracle? We didn't know. It was ominous news. One day, a few weeks after, Michaela was playing ball hockey in her high school gym. Her hip locked up. She had to hobble off the court. It started to hurt more and more. The rheumatologist said, "Some of your femur appears to be dead. You don't need a hip replacement when you're 30. You need one now." As I sat with my client, as she discussed her husband's advancing illness, we discussed the fragility of life, the catastrophe of existence, and the sense of nihilism evoked by the specter of death. I started with my thoughts about my son. She had asked, like everyone in her situation, "Why my husband? Why me? Why this?" My realization of the tight interlinking between vulnerability and being was the best answer I had for her. I told her an old Jewish story, which I believe is part of the commentary on the Torah. It begins with a question, structured like a Zen koan. Imagine a being who is omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent. What does such a being lack? The answer? Limitation. If you are already everything, everywhere, always, there is nowhere to go, and nothing to be. Everything that could be already is, and everything that could happen already has. And it is for this reason, so the story goes, that God created man. No limitation, no story. No story, no being. That idea has helped me deal with the terrible fragility of being. It helped my client, too. I don't want to overstate the significance of this. I don't want to claim that this somehow makes it all okay. She still faced the cancer afflicting her husband, just as I still faced my daughter's terrible illness. But there's something to be said for recognizing that existence and limitation are inextricably linked. Though 30 spokes may form the wheel, it is the hole within the hub which gives the wheel utility. It is not the clay the potter throws which gives the pot its usefulness, but the space within the shape from which the pot is made. Without a door, the room cannot be entered, and without its windows, it is dark. Such is the utility of non-existence. A realization of this sort emerged, more recently, in the pop culture world during the evolution of the DC Comics cultural icon Superman. Superman was created in 1938 by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. In the beginning, he could move cars, trains, and even ships. He could run faster than a locomotive, He could leap over tall buildings in a single bound. As he developed over the next 4 decades, however, Superman's power began to expand. By the late 60s, he could fly faster than light. He had super hearing and X-ray vision. He could blast heat rays from his eyes. He could freeze objects and generate hurricanes with his breath. He could move entire planets. Nuclear blasts didn't faze him. And if he did get hurt somehow, he would immediately heal. Superman became invulnerable. Then a strange thing happened. He got boring. The more amazing his abilities became, the harder it was to think up interesting things for him to do. DC first overcame this problem in the 1940s. Superman became vulnerable to the radiation produced by kryptonite, a material remnant of his shattered home planet. Eventually, more than 2 dozen variants emerged. Green kryptonite weakened Superman. In sufficient dosage, it could even kill him. Red caused him to behave strangely. Red-green caused him to mutate. He once grew a third eye in the back of his head. Other techniques were necessary to keep Superman's story compelling. In 1976, he was scheduled to battle Spider-Man. It was the first superhero crossover between Stan Lee's upstart Marvel Comics with its less idealized characters and DC, the owner of Superman and Batman. But Marvel had to augment Spider-Man's powers for the battle to remain plausible. That broke the rules of the game. Spider-Man is Spider-Man because he has the powers of a spider. If he is suddenly granted any old power, he's not Spider-Man. The plot falls apart. By the 1980s, Superman was suffering from terminal deus ex machina, a Latin term meaning God from a machine. The term described the rescue of the imperiled hero in ancient Greek and Roman plays by the sudden and miraculous appearance of an all-powerful god. In badly written stories to this very day, a character in trouble can be saved, or a failing plot redeemed, by a bit of implausible magic or other chicanery not in keeping with the reader's reasonable expectations. Sometimes Marvel Comics, for example, saves a failing story in exactly this manner. Lifeguard, for example, is an X-Man character who can develop whatever power is necessary to save a life. He's very handy to have around. Other examples abound in popular culture. At the end of Stephen King's The Stand, for example, spoiler alert, God himself destroys the novel's evil characters. The entire ninth season, 1985-86, of the primetime soap Dallas was later revealed as a dream. Fans object to such things, and rightly so. They've been ripped off. People following a story are willing to suspend disbelief as long as the limitations making the story possible are coherent and consistent. Writers, for their part, agree to abide by their initial decisions. When writers cheat, fans get annoyed. They want to toss the book in the fireplace and throw a brick through the TV. And that became Superman's problem. He developed powers so extreme that he could deus himself out of anything at any time. In consequence, in the 1980s, the franchise nearly died. Artist-writer John Byrne successfully rebooted it, rewriting Superman, retaining his biography, but depriving him of many of his new powers. He could no longer lift planets or shrug off an H-bomb. He also became dependent on the sun for his power, like a reverse vampire. He gained some reasonable limitations. A superhero who can do anything turns out to be no hero at all. He's nothing specific, so he's nothing. He has nothing to strive against, so he can't be admirable. Being of any reasonable sort appears to require limitation. Perhaps this is because being requires becoming, as well as mere static existence. And to become is to become something more, or at least something different. That is only possible for something limited. Fair enough. But what about the suffering caused by such limits? Perhaps the limits required by being are so extreme that the whole project should just be scrapped. Dostoevsky expresses this idea very clearly in the voice of the protagonist of Notes from Underground. So, you see, you can say anything about world history, anything and everything that the most morbid imagination can think up, except one thing, that is, it cannot be said that world history is reasonable. The word sticks in one's throat. Goethe's Mephistopheles, the adversary of being, announces his opposition explicitly to God's creation in Faust, as we have seen. Years later, Goethe wrote Faust, Part 2. He has the devil repeat his credo in a slightly different form, just to hammer home the point. Gone, to sheer nothing. Past, with null, made one. What matters our creative endless toil, when at a snatch oblivion ends the coil? It is bygone. How shall this riddle run? As good as if things never had begun. Yet, circle back, existence to possess. I'd rather have eternal emptiness. Anyone can understand such words when a dream collapses, a marriage ends, or a family member is struck down by a devastating disease. How can reality be structured so unbearably? How can this be? Perhaps, as the Columbine boys suggested, see Rule 6, it would be better not to be at all. Perhaps it would even be better if there was no being at all. But people who come to the former conclusion are flirting with suicide, and those who come to the latter with something worse, something truly monstrous. They're consorting with the idea of the destruction of everything. They are toying with genocide, and worse. Even the darkest regions have still darker corners. And what is truly horrifying is that such conclusions are understandable, maybe even inevitable, although not inevitably acted upon. What is a reasonable person to think when faced, for example, with a suffering child? Is it not precisely the reasonable person, the compassionate person, who would find such thoughts occupying his mind? How could a good God allow such a world as this to exist? Logical, they might be. Understandable, they might be. But there is a terrible catch to such conclusions. Acts undertaken in keeping with them, if not the thoughts themselves, inevitably serve to make a bad situation even worse. Hating life, despising life, even for the genuine pain that life inflicts, merely serves to make life itself worse, unbearably worse. There is no genuine protest in that. There's no goodness in that. Only the desire to produce suffering for the sake of suffering. That is the very essence of evil. People who come to that kind of thinking are one step from total mayhem. Sometimes they merely lack the tools. Sometimes, like Stalin, they have their finger on the nuclear button. But is there any coherent alternative, given the self-evident horrors of existence? Can being itself, with its malarial mosquitoes, child soldiers, and degenerative neurological diseases, truly be justified? I'm not sure I could have formulated a proper answer to such a question in the 19th century, before the totalitarian horrors of the 20th were monstrously perpetrated on millions of people. I don't know that it's possible to understand why such doubts are morally impermissible without the fact of the Holocaust and the Stalinist purges and Mao's catastrophic great leap forward. And I also don't think it is possible to answer the question by thinking. Thinking leads inexorably to the abyss. It did not work for Tolstoy. It might not even have worked for Nietzsche, who arguably thought more clearly about such things than anyone in history. But if it is not thinking that can be relied upon in the direst of situations, what is left? Thought, after all, is the highest of human achievements. Is it not? Perhaps not. Something supersedes thinking, despite its truly awesome power. When existence reveals itself as existentially intolerable, thinking collapses in on itself. In such situations, in the depths, it's noticing, not thinking, that does the trick. Perhaps you might start by noticing this. When you love someone, it's not despite their limitations. It's because of their limitations. Of course, it's complicated. You don't have to be in love with every shortcoming and merely accept. You shouldn't stop trying to make life better or let suffering just be. But there appear to be limits on the path to improvement beyond which we might not want to go, lest we sacrifice our humanity itself. Of course, it's one thing to say, being requires limitation, and then to go about happily when the sun is shining and your father is free of Alzheimer's disease and your kids are healthy and your marriage happy. But when things go wrong? Disintegration and pain. Michaela stayed awake many nights when she was in pain. When her grandfather came to visit, he gave her a few of his Tylenol 3s, which contained codeine. Then she could sleep, but not for long. A rheumatologist, instrumental in producing Michaela's remission, hit the limit of her courage when dealing with our child's pain. She had once prescribed opiates to a young girl who became addicted. She swore never to do so again. She said, "Have you tried ibuprofen?" Michaela learned then that doctors don't know everything. Ibuprofen for her was a crumb of bread for a starving man. We talked to a new doctor. He listened carefully. Then he helped Michaela. First, he prescribed T3s, the same medication her grandfather had briefly shared. This was brave. Physicians face a lot of pressure to avoid the prescription of opiates, not least to children. But opiates work. Soon, however, the Tylenol was insufficient. She started taking OxyContin, an opioid known pejoratively as hillbilly heroin. This controlled her pain, but produced other problems. Tammy took Michaela out for lunch a week after the prescription started. She could have been drunk. Her speech was slurred. Her head nodded. This was not good. My sister-in-law is a palliative care nurse. She thought we could add Ritalin, an amphetamine often used for hyperactive kids, to the OxyContin. The Ritalin restored Michaela's alertness and had some pain-suppressing qualities of its own. This is a very good thing to know if you are ever faced with someone's intractable suffering. But her pain became increasingly excruciating. She started to fall. Then her hip seized up on her again, this time in the subway on a day when the escalator was not working. Her boyfriend carried her up the stairs. She took a cab home. The subway was no longer a reliable form of transportation. That March, we bought Michaela a 50cc motor scooter. It was dangerous to let her ride it. It was also dangerous for her to lack all freedom. We chose the former danger. She passed her learner's exam, which allowed her to pilot the vehicle during the day. She was given a few months to progress towards her permanent license. In May, her hip was replaced. The surgeon was even able to adjust for a pre-existent half-centimeter difference in leg length. The bone hadn't died either, That was only a shadow on the X-ray. Her aunt and her grandparents came to see her. We had some better days. Immediately after the surgery, however, Michaela was placed in an adult rehabilitation center. She was the youngest person in the place by about 60 years. Her aged roommate, very neurotic, wouldn't allow the lights to be off, even at night. The old woman couldn't make it to the toilet and had to use a bedpan. She couldn't stand to have the door to her room closed. But it was right beside the nurse's station, with its continual alarm bells and loud conversations. There was no sleeping there, where sleeping was required. No visitors were allowed after 7 p.m. The physio, the very reason for her placement, was on vacation. The only person who helped her was the janitor, who volunteered to move her to a multi-bed ward when she told the on-duty nurse that she couldn't sleep. This was the same nurse who had laughed when she had found out which room Michaela had been assigned to. She was supposed to be there for 6 weeks. She was there 3 days. When the vacationing physio returned, Michaela climbed the rehab center stairs and immediately mastered her additional required exercises. While she was doing that, we outfitted our home with the necessary handrails. Then we took her home. All that pain and surgery? She handled that fine. The appalling rehab center? That produced post-traumatic stress symptoms. Michaela enrolled in a full-fledged motorcycle course in June so she could continue legally using her scooter. We were all terrified by this necessity. What if she fell? What if she had an accident? On the first day, Michaela trained on a real motorcycle. It was heavy. She dropped it several times. She saw another beginning rider tumble and roll across the parking lot where the course was held. On the morning of the second day of the course, she was afraid to return. She didn't want to leave her bed. We talked for a good while and jointly decided that she should at least drive back with Tammy to the site where the training took place. If she couldn't manage it, she could stay in the car until the course finished. En route, her courage returned. When she received her certificate, everyone else enrolled stood and applauded. Then her right ankle disintegrated. Her doctors wanted to fuse the large affected bones into one piece, but that would have caused the other smaller bones in her foot, now facing additional pressure, to deteriorate. That's not so intolerable, perhaps, when you're 80, although it's no picnic then either. But it's no solution when you're in your teens. We insisted upon an artificial replacement, although the technology was new. There was a 3-year waiting list. This was simply not manageable. The damaged ankle produced much more pain than her previously failing hip. One bad night, she became erratic and illogical. I couldn't calm her down. I knew she was at her breaking point. To call that stressful is to say almost nothing. We spent weeks and then months desperately investigating all sorts of replacement devices, trying to assess their suitability. We looked everywhere for quicker surgery. India, China, Spain, the UK, Costa Rica, Florida. We contacted the Ontario Provincial Ministry of Health. They were very helpful. They located a specialist across the country in Vancouver. Michaela's ankle was replaced in November. Post-surgery, she was in absolute agony. Her foot was mispositioned. The cast was compressing skin against bone. The clinic was unwilling to give her enough OxyContin to control her pain. She had built up a high level of tolerance because of her previous use. When she returned home in less pain, Michaela started to taper off the opiates. She hated OxyContin, despite its evident utility. She said it turned her life gray. Perhaps that was a good thing under the circumstances. She stopped using it as soon as possible. She suffered through withdrawal for months with night sweating and formication, the sensation of ants crawling upside down under her skin. She became unable to experience any pleasure. That was another effect of opiate withdrawal. During much of this period, we were overwhelmed. The demands of everyday life don't stop just because you have been laid low by a catastrophe. Everything that you always do still has to be done. So how do you manage? Here are some things we learned. Set aside some time to talk and to think about the illness or other crisis and how it should be managed every day. Do not talk or think about it otherwise. If you do not limit its effect, you will become exhausted and everything will spiral into the ground. This is not helpful. Conserve your strength. You're in a war, not a battle. And a war is composed of many battles. You must stay functional through all of them. When worries associated with the crisis arise at other times, remind yourself that you will think them through during the scheduled period. This usually works. The parts of your brain that generate anxiety are more interested in the fact that there is a plan than in the details of the plan. Don't schedule your time to think in the evening or at night. Then you won't be able to sleep. If you can't sleep, then everything will go rapidly downhill. Shift the unit of time you use to frame your life. When the sun is shining and times are good and the crops are bountiful, you can make your plans for the next month and the next year and the next 5 years. You can even dream a decade ahead. But you can't do that when your leg is clamped firmly in a crocodile's jaws. Sufficient unto the day are the evils thereof. That is Matthew 6:34. It is often interpreted as, live in the present without a care for tomorrow. This is not what it means. That injunction must be interpreted in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, of which it is an integral part. That sermon distills the 10 thou shalt nots of the commandments of Moses into a single prescriptive thou shalt. Christ enjoins his followers to place faith in God's heavenly kingdom and the truth. That's a conscious decision to presume the primary goodness of being. That's an act of courage. Aim high, like Pinocchio's Geppetto. Wish upon a star, and then act properly in accordance with that aim. Once you are aligned with the heavens, you can concentrate on the day. Be careful. Put the things you can control in order. Repair what is in disorder and make what is already good better. It is possible that you can manage if you are careful. People are very tough. People can survive through much pain and loss. But to persevere, they must see the good in being. If they lose that, they are truly lost. Dogs again. But finally, cats. Dogs are like people. They are the friends and allies of human beings. They are social, hierarchical, and domesticated. They are happy at the bottom of the family pyramid. They pay for the attention they receive with loyalty, admiration, and love. Dogs are great. Cats, however, are their own creatures. They aren't social or hierarchical, except in passing. They are only semi-domesticated. They don't do tricks. They are friendly on their own terms. Dogs have been tamed, but cats have made a decision. They appear willing to interact with people for some strange reasons of their own. To me, cats are a manifestation of nature, of being, in an almost pure form. Furthermore, they are a form of being that looks at human beings and approves. When you meet a cat on a street, many things can happen. If I see a cat at a distance, for example, the evil part of me wants to startle it with a loud pfft sound, front teeth over bottom lip. That will make a nervous cat puff up its fur and stand sideways so it looks larger. Maybe I shouldn't laugh at cats, but it's hard to resist. The fact that they can be startled is one of the best things about them, along with the fact that they are instantly disgruntled and embarrassed by their overreaction. But when I have myself under proper control, I'll bend down and call the cat over so I can pet it. Sometimes it will run away. Sometimes it will ignore me completely, because it's a cat. But sometimes the cat will come over to me, push its head against my waiting hand, and be pleased about it. Sometimes it will even roll over and arch its back against the dusty concrete, although cats positioned in that manner will often bite and claw even a friendly hand. Across the street on which I live is a cat named Ginger. Ginger is a Siamese, a beautiful cat, very calm and self-possessed. She is low in the Big Five personality trait of neuroticism, which is an index of anxiety, fear, and emotional pain. Ginger is not at all bothered by dogs. Our dog, Seiko, is her friend. Sometimes when you call her, sometimes of her own accord, Ginger will trot across the street, tail held high, with a little kink at the end. Then she will roll on her back in front of Seiko, who wags his tail happily as a consequence. Afterward, if she feels like it, she might come visit you for half a minute. It's a nice break. It's a little extra light on a good day, and a tiny respite on a bad day. If you pay careful attention, even on a bad day, you may be fortunate enough to be confronted with small opportunities of just that sort. Maybe you will see a little girl dancing on the street because she's all dressed up in a ballet costume. Maybe you will have a particularly good cup of coffee in a cafe that cares about their customers. Maybe you can steal 10 or 20 minutes to do some little ridiculous thing that distracts you or reminds you that you can laugh at the absurdity of existence. Personally, I like to watch a Simpsons episode at 1.5 times regular speed. All the laughs, 2/3 the time. And maybe when you are going for a walk and your head is spinning, a cat will show up, and if you pay attention to it, then you will get a reminder for just 15 seconds that the wonder of being might make up for the ineradicable suffering that accompanies it. Pet a cat when you encounter one on the street. P.S. Soon after I wrote this chapter, Michaela's surgeon told her that her artificial ankle would have to be removed and her ankle fused. Amputation waited down that road. She had been in pain for 8 years since the replacement surgery, and her mobility remained significantly impaired, although both were much better than before. 4 days later, she happened upon a new physiotherapist. He was a large, powerful, attentive person. He had specialized in ankle treatment in the UK, in London. He placed his hands around her ankle and compressed it for 40 seconds while Michaela moved her foot back and forth. A mispositioned bone slipped back where it belonged. Her pain disappeared. She never cries in front of medical personnel, but she burst into tears. Her knee straightened up. Now she can walk long distances and traipse around in her bare feet. The calf muscle on her damaged leg is growing back. She has much more flexion in the artificial joint. This year, she got married and had a baby girl, Elizabeth, named after my wife's departed mother. Things are good. For now. Coda. What shall I do with my newfound pen of light? In late 2016, I traveled to Northern California to meet a friend and business associate. We spent an evening together thinking and talking. At one point, he took a pen from his jacket and took a few notes. It was LED equipped and beamed light out its tip so that writing in the dark was made easier. Just another gadget, I thought. Later, however, in a more metaphorical frame of mind, I was struck quite deeply by the idea of a pen of light. There was something symbolic about it, something metaphysical. We're all in the dark, after all, much of the time. We could all use something written with light to guide us along our way. I told him I wanted to do some writing while we sat and conversed, and I asked him if he would give me the pen as a gift. When he handed it over, I found myself inordinately pleased. Now I could write illuminated words in the darkness. Obviously, it was important to do such a thing properly. So I said to myself, in all seriousness, what shall I do with my newfound pen of light? There are two verses in the New Testament that pertain to such things. I've thought about them a lot. Ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be open unto you. For everyone who asks, receives. The one who seeks, finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Matthew 7:7-7:8. At first glance, this seems like nothing but a testament to the magic of prayer, in the sense of entreating God to grant favors. But God, whatever or whoever he may be, is no simple granter of wishes. When tempted by the devil himself in the desert, as we saw in Rule 7, pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient, even Christ himself was not willing to call upon his Father for a favor. Furthermore, every day, the prayers of desperate people go unanswered. But maybe this is because the questions they contain are not phrased in the proper manner. Perhaps it's not reasonable to ask God to break the rules of physics every time we fall by the wayside or make a serious error. Perhaps, in such times, you can't put the cart before the horse and simply wish for your problem to be solved in some magical manner. Perhaps you could ask instead what you might have to do right now to increase your resolve, buttress your character, and find the strength to go on. Perhaps you could instead ask to see the truth. On many occasions in our nearly 30 years of marriage, my wife and I have had a disagreement, sometimes a deep disagreement. Our unity appeared to be broken at some unknowably profound level, and we were not able to easily resolve the rupture by talking. We became trapped instead in emotional, angry, and anxious argument. We agreed that when such circumstances arose, we would separate briefly. She to one room, me to another. This was often quite difficult, because it is hard to disengage in the heat of an argument when anger generates the desire to defeat and win. But it seemed better than risking the consequences of a dispute that threatened to spiral out of control. Alone, trying to calm down, we would each ask ourselves the same single question. What had we each done to contribute to the situation we were arguing about? However small, however distant, we had each made some error. Then we would reunite and share the results of our questioning. Here's how I was wrong. The problem with asking yourself such a question is that you must truly want the answer. And the problem with doing that is that you won't like the answer. When you are arguing with someone, you want to be right, and you want the other person to be wrong. Then it's them that has to sacrifice something and change, not you, and that's much preferable. If it's you that's wrong, and you that must change, then you have to reconsider yourself, your memories of the past, your manner of being in the present, and your plans for the future. Then you must resolve to improve and figure out how to do that. Then you actually have to do it. That's exhausting. It takes repeated practice to instantiate the new perceptions and make the new actions habitual. It's much easier just not to realize, admit, and engage. It's much easier to turn your attention away from the truth and remain willfully blind. But it's at such a point that you must decide whether you want to be right or you want to have peace. You must decide whether to insist upon the absolute correctness of your view or to listen and negotiate. You don't get peace by being right. You just get to be right while your partner gets to be wrong, defeated and wrong. Do that 10,000 times and your marriage will be over, or you will wish it was. To choose the alternative, to seek peace, you have to decide that you want the answer more than you want to be right. That's the way out of the prison of your stubborn preconceptions. That's the prerequisite for negotiation. That's to truly abide by the principle of Rule 2. Treat yourself like someone you are responsible for helping. My wife and I learned that if you ask yourself such a question, and you genuinely desire the answer, no matter how disgraceful and terrible and shameful, then a memory of something you did that was stupid and wrong at some point in the generally not distant enough past will arise from the depths of your mind. Then you can go back to your partner and reveal why you're an idiot and apologize sincerely. And that person can do the same for you and then apologize sincerely. And then you two idiots will be able to talk again. Perhaps that is true prayer. The question, what have I done wrong? And what can I do now to set things at least a little bit more right? But your heart must be open to the terrible truth. You must be receptive to that which you do not want to hear. When you decide to learn about your faults so that they can be rectified, you open a line of communication with the source of all revelatory thought. Maybe that's the same thing as consulting your conscience. Maybe that's the same thing, in some manner, as a discussion with God. It was in that spirit, with some paper in front of me, that I asked my question. What shall I do with my newfound pen of light? I asked, as if I truly wanted the answer. I waited for a reply. I was holding a conversation between two different elements of myself. I was genuinely thinking, or listening, in the sense described in Rule 9, assume that the person you are listening to might know something you don't. That rule can apply as much to yourself as to others. It was me, of course, who asked the question, and it was me, of course, who replied. But those two me's were not the same. I did not know what the answer would be. I was waiting for it to appear in the theater of my imagination. I was waiting for the words to spring out of the void. How can a person think up something that surprises him? How can he already not know what he thinks? Where do new thoughts come from? Who or what thinks them? Since I had just been given, of all things, a pen of light, which could write illuminated words in the darkness, I wanted to do the best thing I could with it. So I asked the appropriate question, and almost immediately an answer revealed itself. Write down the words you want inscribed on your soul. I wrote that down. That seemed pretty good. A little on the romantic side, granted, but that was in keeping with the game. Then I upped the ante. I decided to ask myself the hardest questions I could think up and await their answers. If you have a pen of light, after all, you should use it to answer difficult questions. Here was the first. What shall I do tomorrow? The answer came. The most good possible in the shortest period of time. That was satisfying as well, conjoining an ambitious aim with the demands of maximal efficiency, a worthy challenge. The second question was in the same vein. What shall I do next year? Try to ensure that the good I do then will be exceeded only by the good I do the year after that. That seemed solid, too, a nice extension of the ambitions detailed in the previous answer. I told my friend that I was trying a serious experiment in writing with the pen he had given to me. I asked if I could read aloud what I had composed so far. The questions and the answers struck a chord with him, too. That was good. That was impetus to continue. The next question ended the first set. What shall I do with my life? Aim for paradise and concentrate on today. Ha! I knew what that meant. It's what Geppetto does in the Disney movie Pinocchio when he wishes upon a star. The grandfatherly woodcarver lifts up his eyes to the twinkling diamond set high above the mundane world of day-to-day human concerns and articulates his deepest desire, that the marionette he created lose the strings by which he is manipulated by others and transform himself into a real boy. It's also the central message of the Sermon on the Mount, as we saw in Rule 4, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, but which deserves repeating here. And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Matthew 6:28-6:33. What does all that mean? Orient yourself properly. Then, and only then, concentrate on the day. Set your sights at the good, the beautiful, and the true, and then focus pointedly and carefully on the concerns of each moment. Aim continually at heaven while you work diligently on earth. Attend fully to the future in that manner, while attending fully to the present. Then you have the best chance of perfecting both. I turned, then, from the use of time to my relationships with people, and wrote down and then read these questions and answers to my friend. What shall I do with my wife? Treat her as if she is the Holy Mother of God, so that she may give birth to the world-redeeming hero. What shall I do with my daughter? Stand behind her, listen to her, guard her, train her mind, and let her know it's okay if she wants to be a mother. What shall I do with my parents? Act such that your actions justify the suffering they endured. What shall I do with my son? Encourage him to be a true son of God. To honor your wife as a mother of God is to notice and support the sacred element of her role as mother, not just of your children, but as such. A society that forgets this cannot survive. Hitler's mother gave birth to Hitler, and Stalin's mother to Stalin. Was something amiss in their crucial relationships? It seems likely, given the importance of the maternal role in establishing trust, to take a single vital example. Perhaps the importance of their motherly duties and of their relationship with their children was not properly stressed. Perhaps what the women were doing in their maternal guise was not properly regarded by husband, father, and society alike. Who instead might a woman produce if she was treated properly, honorably, and carefully? After all, the fate of the world rests on each new infant, tiny, fragile, and threatened, but in time, capable of uttering the words and doing the deeds that maintain the eternal, delicate balance between chaos and order. To stand behind my daughter? That's to encourage her in everything she wants courageously to do, but to include in that genuine appreciation for the fact of her femininity, to recognize the importance of having a family and children, and to forego the temptation to denigrate or devalue that in comparison to accomplishment of personal ambition or career. It's not for nothing that the Holy Mother and infant is a divine image, as we just discussed. Societies that cease to honor that image, that cease to see that relationship as of transcendent and fundamental importance, also cease to be. To act to justify the suffering of your parents is to remember all the sacrifices that all the others who lived before you, not least your parents, have made for you in all the course of the terrible past, to be grateful for all the progress that has been thereby made, and then to act in accordance with that remembrance and gratitude. People sacrificed immensely to bring about what we have now. In many cases, they literally died for it, and we should act with some respect for that fact. To encourage my son to be a true son of God? That is to want him above all to do what is right and to strive to have his back while he is doing so. That is, I think, part of the sacrificial message, to value and support your son's commitment to transcendent good above all things, including his worldly progress, so to speak, and his safety, and perhaps even his life. I continued asking questions. The answers came within seconds. What shall I do with the stranger? Invite him into my house and treat him like a brother so that he may become one. That's to extend the hand of trust to someone so that his or her best part can step forward and reciprocate. That's to manifest the sacred hospitality that makes life between those who do not yet know each other possible. What shall I do with a fallen soul? Offer a genuine and cautious hand, but do not join it in the mire. That's a good summary of what we covered in Rule 3. Make friends with people who want the best for you. That's an injunction to refrain both from casting pearls before swine and from camouflaging your vice with virtue. What shall I do with the world? Conduct myself as if being is more valuable than non-being. Act so that you are not made bitter and corrupt by the tragedy of existence. That's the essence of Rule 1. Stand up straight with your shoulders back. Confront the uncertainty of the world voluntarily and with faith and courage. How shall I educate my people? Share with them those things I regard as truly important. That's Rule 8. Tell the truth, or at least, don't lie. That is to aim for wisdom, to distill that wisdom into words, and to speak forth those words as if they matter, with true concern and care. That's all relevant as well to the next question and answer. What shall I do with a torn nation? Stitch it back together with careful words of truth. The importance of this injunction has, if anything, become clearer over the past few years. We are dividing and polarizing and drifting toward chaos. It is necessary under such conditions, if we are to avoid catastrophe, for each of us to bring forward the truth as we see it, not the arguments that justify our ideologies, not the machinations that further our ambitions, but the stark, pure facts of our existence, revealed for others to see and contemplate, so that we can find common ground and proceed together. What shall I do for God, my Father? Sacrifice everything I hold dear to yet greater perfection. Let the dead wood burn off so that new growth can prevail. That's the terrible lesson of Cain and Abel, detailed in the discussion of meaning surrounding Rule 7. What shall I do with a lying man? Let him speak so that he may reveal himself. Rule 9, listen, is once again relevant here, as is another section of the New Testament. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. Neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Matthew 7:16-7:20. The rot must be revealed before something sound can be put in its place, as was also indicated in Rule 7's elaboration. And all of this is pertinent to understanding the following question and answer. How shall I deal with the enlightened one? Replace him with the true seeker of enlightenment. There is no enlightened one. There is only the one who is seeking further enlightenment. Proper being is process, not a state, a journey, not a destination. It's the continual transformation of what you know through encounter with what you don't know, rather than the desperate clinging to the certainty that is eternally insufficient in any case. That accounts for the importance of Rule 4. Compare yourself. Always place your becoming above your current being. That means it is necessary to recognize and accept your insufficiency so that it can be continually rectified. That's painful, certainly, but it's a good deal. The next few Q&As made another coherent group, focused this time on ingratitude. What shall I do when I despise what I have? Remember those who have nothing and strive to be grateful. Take stock of what is right in front of you. Consider Rule 12, somewhat tongue-in-cheek. Pet a cat when you encounter one on the street. Consider as well that you may be blocked in your progress, not because you lack opportunity, but because you have been too arrogant to make full use of what already lies in front of you. That's Rule 6. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. I spoke recently with a young man about such things. He had barely ever left his family and never his home state, but he journeyed to Toronto to attend one of my lectures and to meet with me at my home. He had isolated himself far too severely in the short course of his life to date and was badly plagued by anxiety. When we first met, he could hardly speak. He had nonetheless determined in the last year to do something about all of that. He started by taking on the lowly job of dishwasher. He decided to do it well when he could have treated it contemptuously, intelligent enough to be embittered by a world that did not recognize his gifts. He decided instead to accept with the genuine humility that is the true precursor to wisdom whatever opportunity he could find. Now he lives on his own. That's better than living at home. Now he has some money. Not much, but more than none, and he earned it. Now he is confronting the social world and benefiting from the ensuing conflict. Knowledge frequently results from knowing others, but the man who is awakened has seen the uncarved block. others might be mastered by force, but to master oneself requires the Tao. He who has many material things may be described as rich, but he who knows he has enough and is at one with the Tao might have enough of material things and have self-being as well. As long as my still anxious but self-transforming and determined visitor continues down his current path, he will become far more competent and accomplished, and it won't take long. But this will only be because he accepted his lowly state and was sufficiently grateful to take the first equally lowly step away from it. That's far preferable to waiting endlessly for the magical arrival of Godo. That's far preferable to arrogant, static, unchanging existence while the demons of rage, resentment, and unlived life gather around. What shall I do when greed consumes me? Remember that it is truly better to give than to receive. The world is a forum of sharing and trading. That's Rule 7 again. Not a treasure house for the plundering. To give is to do what you can to make things better. The good in people will respond to that and support it and imitate it and multiply it and return it and foster it so that everything improves and moves forward. What shall I do when I ruin my rivers? Seek for the living water and let it cleanse the earth. I found this question, as well as its answer, particularly unexpected. It seems most associated with Rule 6, set your house. Perhaps our environmental problems are not best construed technically. Maybe they're best considered psychologically. The more people sort themselves out, the more responsibility they will take for the world around them, and the more problems they will solve. It is better, proverbially, to rule your own spirit than to rule a city. It's easier to subdue an enemy without than one within. Maybe the environmental problem is ultimately spiritual. If we put ourselves in order, perhaps we will do the same for the world. Of course, what else would a psychologist think? The next set were associated with proper response to crisis and exhaustion. What shall I do when my enemy succeeds? Aim a little higher and be grateful for the lesson. Back to Matthew. Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. 5:43-5:45. What does this mean? Learn from the success of your enemies. Listen, Rule 9, to their critique, so that you can glean from their opposition whatever fragments of wisdom you might incorporate to your betterment. Adopt as your ambition the creation of a world in which those who work against you see the light and wake up and succeed, so that the better at which you are aiming can encompass them too. What shall I do when I'm tired and impatient? Gratefully accept an outstretched helping hand. This is something with a twofold meaning. It's an injunction, first, to note the reality of the limitations of individual being, and second, to accept and be thankful for the support of others, family, friends, acquaintances, and strangers alike. Exhaustion and impatience are inevitable. There is too much to be done and too little time in which to do it. But we don't have to strive alone. And there is nothing but good in distributing the responsibilities, cooperating in the efforts, and sharing credit for the productive and meaningful work thereby undertaken. What shall I do with the fact of aging? Replace the potential of my youth with the accomplishments of my maturity. This harkens back to the discussion of friendship surrounding Rule 3 and the story of Socrates' trial and death, which might be summarized as follows. A life lived thoroughly justifies its own limitations. The young man with nothing has his possibilities to set against the accomplishments of his elders. It's not clear that it's necessarily a bad deal for either. An aged man is but a paltry thing, wrote William Butler Yeats. A tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing, for every tatter in its mortal dress. What shall I do with my infant's death? Hold my other loved ones, and heal their pain. It is necessary to be strong in the face of death, because death is intrinsic to life. It is for this reason that I tell my students, aim to be the person at your father's funeral that everyone in their grief and misery can rely on. There's a worthy and noble ambition, strength in the face of adversity. That is very different from the wish for a life free of trouble. What shall I do in the next dire moment? Focus my attention on the next right move. The flood is coming. The flood is always coming. The apocalypse is always upon us. That's why the story of Noah is archetypal. Things fall apart. We stress that in the discussion surrounding Rule 10, be precise in your speech. And the center cannot hold. When everything has become chaotic and uncertain, all that remains to guide you might be the character you constructed previously by aiming up and concentrating on the moment at hand. If you have failed in that, you will fail in the moment of crisis, and then God help you. That last set contained what I thought were the most difficult of all the questions I asked that night. The death of a child is perhaps the worst of catastrophes. Many relationships fail in the aftermath of such a tragedy. But dissolution in the face of such horror is not inevitable, although it is understandable. I have seen people immensely strengthen their remaining family bonds when someone close to them has died. I have seen them turn to those who remained and redouble their efforts to connect with them and support them. Because of that, all regained at least some of what had been so terribly torn away by death. We must, therefore, commiserate in our grief. We must come together in the face of the tragedy of existence. Our families can be the living room with the fireplace that is cozy and welcoming and warm while the storms of winter rage outside. The heightened knowledge of fragility and mortality produced by death can terrify, embitter, and separate. It can also awaken. It can remind those who grieve not to take the people who love them for granted. Once I did some chilling calculations regarding my parents, who are in their 80s. It was an example of the hated arithmetic we encountered in the discussion of Rule 5. Do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. And I walked through the equations so that I would stay properly conscious. I see my mom and dad about twice a year. We generally spend several weeks together. We talk on the phone in the interim between visits. But the life expectancy of people in their 80s is under 10 years. That means I am likely to see my parents, if I am fortunate, fewer than 20 more times. That's a terrible thing to know. But knowing it puts a stop to my taking those opportunities for granted. The next set of questions and answers had to do with the development of character. What shall I say to a faithless brother? The king of the damned is a poor judge of being. It is my firm belief that the best way to fix the world, a handyman's dream if ever there was one, is to fix yourself, as we discussed in Rule 6. anything else is presumptuous. Anything else risks harm stemming from your ignorance and lack of skill. That's okay. There's plenty to do right where you are. After all, your specific personal faults detrimentally affect the world. Your conscious voluntary sins, because no other word really works, makes things worse than they have to be. Your inaction, inertia, and cynicism removes from the world that part of you that could learn to quell suffering and make peace. That's not good. There are endless reasons to despair of the world and to become angry and resentful and to seek revenge. Failure to make the proper sacrifices, failure to reveal yourself, failure to live and tell the truth, all that weakens you. In that weakened state, you will be unable to thrive in the world, and you will be of no benefit to yourself or to others. You will fail and suffer stupidly. That will corrupt your soul. How could it be otherwise? Life is hard enough when it is going well, but when it's going badly? And I have learned through painful experience that nothing is going so badly that it can't be made worse. This is why hell is a bottomless pit. This is why hell is associated with that aforementioned sin. In the most awful of cases, the terrible suffering of unfortunate souls becomes attributable by their own judgment to mistakes they made knowingly in the past. Acts of betrayal, deception, cruelty, carelessness, cowardice, and most commonly of all, willful blindness. To suffer terribly and to know yourself as the cause? That is hell. And once in hell, it is very easy to curse being itself. And no wonder. But it's not justifiable. And that's why the king of the damned is a poor judge of being. How do you build yourself into someone on whom you can rely in the best of times and the worst, in peace and in war? How do you build for yourself the kind of character that will not ally itself in its suffering and misery with all who dwell in hell? The questions and answers continued, all pertinent in one way or another to the rules that I have outlined in this book. What shall I do to strengthen my spirit? Do not tell lies or do what you despise. What shall I do to ennoble my body? Use it only in the service of my soul. What shall I do with the most difficult of questions? Consider them the gateway to the path of life. What shall I do with the poor man's plight? Strive through right example to lift his broken heart. What shall I do when the great crowd beckons? Stand tall and utter my broken truths. And that was that. I still have my pen of light. I haven't written anything with it since. Maybe I will again when the mood strikes and something wells up from deep below. But even if I don't, it helped me find the words to properly close this book. I hope that my writing has proved useful to you. I hope it revealed things you knew that you did not know you knew. I hope the ancient wisdom I discussed provides you with strength. I hope it brightened the spark within you. I hope you can straighten up, sort out your family, and bring peace and prosperity to your community. I hope, in accordance with Rule 11, do not bother children when they are skateboarding, that you strengthen and encourage those who are committed to your care, instead of protecting them to the point of weakness. I wish you all the best, and hope that you can wish the best for others. What will you write with your pen of light? We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos by Jordan B. Peterson. This program was produced by Ann Jansen, Director Pedro Mendez. Text copyright 2018, Luminate Psychological Services Limited. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House Canada Limited. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.